Hi everyone, I'm Eve Rees.
And I'm Claire Wright.
And we are historians. If this introduction sounds to you like a confession or an act of sharing our addictions, well, you're right. We are here to tell you about our addiction to the archives.
So welcome to our podcast, Archive Fever, where each episode we conduct intimate conversations with writers, artists, curators, fellow historians, and other victims of the research bug.
We're going to talk to these archive addicts about what kind of archives they use, how often they use them, when they got their first hit, and what is their funniest, saddest, most frustrating, and most illuminating experience in the archives.
And once again, we'll be asking the question, what madness is this?
We'd like to begin today by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land on which Claire and I are presently enjoying occupancy in what we call Melbourne today. That is, the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, whose land was stolen and whose sovereignty was never ceded.
Eve, there's not a whole lot that we have COVID-19 to thank for, but one beneficial outcome of the global pandemic is that we've all become completely accustomed to using digital platforms to conduct our meetings and interviews. And this transformation has meant that here at Archive Fever, we've been able to expand our wish list of guests to include our favourite international archive addicts. So today it is our very great pleasure and total thrill to be speaking with American novelist Sarah Sliger from her home in California. Welcome, Sarah.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Just a quick introduction for Australian listeners. Sarah Sliger is an author and academic based in Los Angeles, where she teaches English and creative writing as a postdoctoral fellow at the University of Southern California. Sarah holds a PhD in English from the University of Pennsylvania and a Master's in History from the University of Cambridge. Sarah's academic research focuses on 20th and 21st century American fiction, film, and television. Her forthcoming scholarly book, an expansion of her PhD dissertation, studies the development of the legal procedural genre in the context of historical changes to American criminal procedure, for which Sarah's elevator pitch is, it's kind of like a prehistory of law and order. But because we're at peak nerd here at Archive Fever HQ, I'm going to give you the high-rise version. Sarah's doctoral work argues that the legal procedural emerged across media in response to anxieties about region, race, individual rights, and a rapidly changing criminal justice system, while her master's research focused on museum culture and its intersections with political violence, in particular the use of art vandalism as a militant tactic by the British women's suffrage movement. And now you know why we're so keen to have her on Archive Fever. Sarah's first novel is Take Me Apart, a taut, sexy, psychological thriller that combines the crime fiction genres of the art world mystery with the library mystery. Think The Girl with the Pearl Earring meets Possession, only with a main protagonist who is an archivist, and it's not really crime fiction. Take Me Apart has appeared on the Best Books of 2020 lists of too many US publications for me to recount here. Sarah, a huge thank you for joining us and welcome to Archives Anonymous.
Thank you so much. That was such a generous introduction.
Sarah, Eve and I both consumed your book in a red-hot weekend of reading frenzy. Congratulations. It's just such a wonderful read. Your heroine, who we know from the outset might be an unreliable witness, is 30-year-old Kate Aitken, a broken young woman putting herself back together again by accepting the job archiving the personal papers of a rich, dead and dead famous artist, Miranda Brand. Kate is an accidental archivist, but you've clearly made historical sleuthing a deliberate career choice. When did you first get bitten by the research bug?
I'm struggling to think back to, you know, when was the beginning, because I feel like probably like a lot of us, I've always sort of had that fascination with just finding out kind of as much as possible about something, and the kind of joy of like getting sucked down the path of researching in very amateur ways. I feel like that's just a feature of my personality for most of my life. You know, I did sort of research projects in high school and college that involved primary sources and sort of had, you know, some kind of experiences there. And I guess it just sort of built up as an interest. I'm just struggling to think of one specific moment, but I feel like it was sort of more of a gradual intensification.
So if it's part of your personality trait, do you think that there's a kind of personality type that predisposes one to becoming an archive addict? Do some of us have a vulnerability?
I think there are probably a few different personalities that could become interested in archives, depending partly on like what your relationship is to the archive, right? So people who are really organizational, for example, might find a lot of pleasure in cataloging and in sort of sorting into these manageable, digestible sort of frameworks and finding aids and catalogs that we're used to reading. I'm not a very organized person. I don't know if I would call it a vulnerability. I feel like I love the problem solving element of it, you know, figuring out, okay, well, this is what I want to know. How would I go about knowing that? You know, how would I prove that? What would I need to find? Because as we know, there's so many different kinds of archives. They're all organized so differently. And you have to really figure out a lot about the system before you're able to get any information out of it. And I think that that desire to find the solution, I feel like for me, is something that is really strong. And I think is probably true for a lot of people who are interested in archives. But I definitely don't really presume to speak for everyone who has, you know, the archive bug.
So you use the expression before going down the hole when you're in research mode. What does archive fever feel like for you? When you're in the hole, what does your body feel like? What is it telling you?
I feel like maybe like a kind of intense pressure or something in the chest, right? And you find yourself sort of hunched over the computer in this like really intense way. I think also though, you know, that feeling of being like truly in the hole is you've sort of forgotten about your body in a lot of ways, right? Which is the only way you can sit for like 8 hours in an archive and not be so like desperate to get up. If I'm like really into researching something, I don't know if I notice my body that much in the moment.
And you've written that one of your motivations for your novel, Take Me Apart, was to kind of recreate this feeling of going down the archival hole for readers. You've written elsewhere that I wanted to write a novel that showed the addictive thrill of archival research as a kind of detective work. So how did you go about recreating this addictive thrill in a novel? What kind of literary strategies did you use to do that?
That's a great question. You know, when I started out writing the novel, part of what I had really wanted to convey was the total boredom of working in archives, because it is just really boring sometimes. And like a lot of times you don't find the thing you're looking for. And so I was really interested, you know, in that boredom. And then, you know, my editor sort of explained that if it's a thriller, it shouldn't really be boring. And I kind of understood that concept that I didn't want to bore the reader. So I think that one of the things that was hardest for me to achieve in the novel was like recognize that that is a part of it without the reader experiencing that part. The way the novel is structured for people who haven't read it is that it sort of alternates between this present day narrator, Kate, and all of these different kind of documents and found items from the photographer, Miranda. So you see medical records, report cards, postcards. She has a journal that you start to see a lot of entries from. And I think by putting all of those sources together and putting the reader in a little bit more of a position where they're looking for the clues, I think that that was kind of the most effective strategy that I had for imitating the archival experience, was just to sort of create a ideally rewarding archival experience, right? So like take out all the boredom from those sections and make it a kind of research hole that has some payoff at the end.
It's a really fascinating combination of what is the best part of any kind of writing in a novel or nonfiction, which is the reader wants to know what happens next. That's what you want the reader to be feeling. But in this case, it's also, what am I going to find next? And that's that sense of the detective part of it as well, that archivists or people who work in the archives absolutely know. But I'm particularly interested in one thing, a moment where Miranda says, the key to art is a sense of something suffering beyond the edges of the frame. It occurred to me that maybe this is the key to archive fever too, that anxiety and compulsion that comes from the fear that there's something lurking just beyond the edges of that file that's in your hand. You know, maybe what you're looking for is in the next file or in a different box or would come up in the catalogue under a different keyword. Does that resonate with you, that sort of feverish search for what lies outside the frame?
It does. And I do think, you know, going back to the original question about personality types, that I think there is probably that kind of collector mentality a little bit, the complete picture, the complete collection. You know, fundamentally, like a collection, for example, is working around this idea of something being missing, right? Like something has to be missing for it to be a collection. If it's totally complete, you're no longer in the act of collecting and there's not that kind of drive behind it. So I think it loses a lot of its power. It's not like as inspiring. For me personally, I think it's like more inspiring to see like 10 objects, and we know there were like 40,000 in existence, but there's only like 10 now that people have found. To me, I think that's like super fascinating and perhaps more fascinating than seeing 400 objects and we know 400 were made. Like there's something interesting to me about that thing that is lost and unrecoverable. So yes, there's like a fantasy of recovering the thing that's unrecoverable. And that's kind of what Kate experiences when she finds this diary that, and all of these documents that nobody had seen before. But I also think as an archive lover, as a reader, I think that we are interested in that feeling of like wanting there to be something that comes next. Like that's where the suspense is coming from. And once Kate has what she feels is the whole picture, you know, the story's done. So it's kind of, I guess, a balance, I would say, between like having that desire, that fantasy, but also understanding that like the act of desiring is part of what's pleasurable about the experience.
Sarah, as you've noted, archives are often defined by their silences, by their missing pieces, as much as by their contents. You know, as we know, the voices of the powerful tend to be centered while oppressed peoples and experiences tend to be excluded. And so archives themselves, you know, become complicit in maintaining relations of power. After reading your novel, Take Me Apart, I was really struck by the way this novel dives into marginalized experiences and taboo topics that are often silenced in sort of conventional institutional archives. I'm thinking of, you know, themes of mental illness, female creativity and ambition, gendered violence. So in a way, you could say that your fiction about archives says many things that actual archives often do not. And that made me wonder, is this book in part an attempt to kind of write back against the silences in the archives? Are you using fiction to kind of fill in the blanks?
Yeah, for sure. I don't know if I would say I'm using fiction to fill in the blanks of another specific archive, because obviously this one is fictional. But the idea of archival silence, the idea of objects going missing, not only through different acts of fate or whatever, but also because there are sort of institutional pressures or family pressures. When I started working on the novel, something that really motivated me was wanting to address these archival silences, gaps that are created either through fateful occurrences or random happenstance, but also through these institutional pressures. And in Miranda's case, the kind of neglect, a symptom or an outcome of what we learn is a really bad situation. So I won't, you know, go into any more details, but I definitely, I guess, wanted to think about how the people who are in charge of preserving archives are often also complicit in some of the traumas that the archives themselves would recount. That's something that is really hard to repair in the world. It's really hard to undo institutional failures to preserve something, to translate something, to record or organize it. And in fiction, you know, you have that power because you're sort of inventing the thing. So it definitely was something that I was thinking about, maybe a little bit of wish fulfillment.
One of the major themes of the novel is transgression, and particularly how we cover the tracks of our moral and ethical trespass. Kate is given permission to archive Miranda's papers, but not access to her diary, which she discovers in a drawer in Miranda's son Theo's bedroom while she's snooping there, which then has to become a secret she keeps from Theo, who is her boss and, spoiler alert, her lover. Do you think that all archival research is in some way an act of snooping, of kind of documentary grave robbing?
I think that there is a lot of that. There are a lot of really complex ethical questions that are raised around archives. Grave robbing is sort of an extreme expression that I think is applicable to some situations and not to others. But I do think that in conducting any kind of archival research, researchers have to be really thoughtful about their relationship, you know, to the person whose work or whose objects they're consuming. And I think that's something that Kate grapples with, the idea that, you know, Miranda was this very private person, probably wouldn't want a lot of these things made public, right? You know, there were reasons maybe she chose not to come forward about them herself. And so this kind of tension between what Kate thinks Miranda would have wanted and what Theo, Miranda's son, thinks his mother would have wanted, and then kind of what we see Miranda want through her diary. I think I did want the conflict between all of those to become clear.
And Kate, as the archivist, is certainly not a neutral character. She harbors her own dark side, but she also finds disturbing and sordid scenes lurk in Miranda's archives, Miranda's dark side. So this points to another of the book's preoccupations. I think that's the gulf between our private, secret selves and the selves we willingly show the world. In Miranda's diary, Kate finds the words, "Imagine if they really knew who I am." In Miranda's case, as Kate comes to discover, the reality is that Miranda, who is an outspoken feminist photographer who takes frank, explicit self-portraits, is actually abused by her husband, is often depressed, and is completely manipulated and exploited by her manager. So that expression, "imagine if they really knew who I am," is this the question we ask ourselves, all of us, all of the time? And is the fear of exposure, or perhaps the latent desire for exposure, heightened in our social media age of our curated selfies and our airbrushed Instagram posts?
I always hesitate to make any statement that is, you know, do we all feel this, something like that. I just feel like making those generalizations obscures more than it reveals. So I'm not going to say that anything is something we all feel. I do think that this tension between people's self-presentation and what they're experiencing on the inside, and I think, you know, some people take a lot of pride in feeling that that's a very transparent relationship, and some people deliberately cultivate these social media personalities that feel really estranged from them. And I think that that really differs a lot from person to person. But I think that those differences are kind of flattened through social media. So when we look at scrolling through Instagram or something, for all we know, these people are presenting themselves transparently, right? Like, we have no idea if there's that kind of like opaque relationship there, if they're deliberately or unintentionally cultivating this image.
I appreciate your suggestion that you can't speak for everybody. But one of the things I really loved about the book is that, kind of a bit like Shakespeare, it engages in really universal themes, these ideas of transgression. And I suppose what we're talking about now is a kind of search for authenticity, which has a universal feel to it. And just to get back to the archives, does the archive promise authenticity, i.e. fact, but really deliver its own version of fiction?
I think that, you know, the archive offers up fact, but in the act of interpreting, that's where there's a kind of fictional addition, right? So I think the archive itself is inert in some ways, but when people are experiencing it, reading it, including it in research, even cataloging it, which was something that was important to me to show in the book, that these are really deliberate decisions, and they rely a lot on the interpreter's sort of understanding of the document. And I think that does involve a lot of sort of point of view. And it is fictional, you know, it's sort of a projection of the interpreter's self onto these objects.
On that question of interpretation, the way you've structured the novel by having Miranda's story told through original archival documents in a way leaves the task of interpretation up to the reader. The reader becomes the researcher encountering these documents, as it were, for the first time. Have you found that readers have come up with kind of differing interpretations of what these documents mean? And why did you decide to hand over that interpretive power to the reader in the first place?
I'm trying to think of like if there's a specific example I can think of where someone interpreted a document differently. And I can't think of a specific example, partly because I stopped reading reviews of the book, because it's a really raw and painful experience, especially when you're a debut novelist and your whole book tour got canceled because of the pandemic. And, you know, it just is sort of a difficult place to be reading reviews from, whether they're positive or negative. It feels really vulnerable for me. So in some ways, I don't have much of a sense of how individual people have responded to individual parts, but I certainly hope that people are interpreting it differently. I did want that to be something that happened naturally for the reader, and also that the reader kind of became aware of. I hope that the kind of way the book is organized and the characters' interactions with different documents is sort of drawing the reader's attention to their own interaction with the book and with those documents.
As Claire mentioned in the introduction, you've also worked extensively with archives as an academic, but you've now written a novel also about archives. How did becoming a novelist change your relationship with archives?
Well, I think I spend less time in archives now than I did before, for one thing. You know, a lot of my intensive, like, physical archive work was in my master's, which was like more historical. I still do archival work though, both in person and a lot online, because now I mostly research kind of later 20th century stuff that's usually really well digitized. I think it's just made me, I guess, a little bit more conscious of the experience of being there and more conscious of my own sort of like interpretive power. I guess it's made me feel like closer to archives in some ways, because I sort of did this labor of love all about them. I mean, I think they're cool. They're great places. It's just sort of like writing the novel has sort of enriched that experience.
Sarah, I have to ask the question. Eve and I are both academics who engage publicly as much as we can, but neither of us have written a novel. My editor says that I'm not brave enough to write a novel. I'm really keen to know which is more fun, writing academic prose or writing fiction?
That's a no-brainer, surely.
I would say writing fiction is more fun. I mean, interestingly, they use really different parts of my brain. And even though it might sort of seem, because of my CV, that I was sort of just an academic and then I was like, oh, writing a novel would be fun. You know, I've been wanting to be an author and writing fiction since I was a little kid writing stories about myself as like an imaginary extra member of the Spice Girls or whatever. So I've been writing fiction a really long time. And I think that more what happened is that when I started working on this novel, I wanted to kind of pour out a lot of my thoughts and emotions and feelings about archives into it. It just felt like a topic that I knew a lot about and was passionate about and also wanted to understand better for myself. So for me, they've always sort of been kind of two halves of my life in some ways. And, you know, I'm going to go on to write more novels that aren't about archives at all. I would say writing fiction is more fun in terms of like, there's just an ability to do a lot more experimentation. And I think what appeals to me about academic writing is much more that sense of problem solving that I was talking about earlier. You know, in the act of writing, this is what I know. This is how I can like express that in a way that also, you know, goes toward my argument and sort of arranging things in that way. It's funny because they're both sitting behind the computer writing, but to me, they really feel very different on an experiential level.
Do you feel like you learnt more about yourself writing a novel than you have, say, doing your academic work? I'm just curious because you've noted elsewhere that archives are psychologically revealing. You wrote that any archive tells us not only about the psychology of the person who created or saved the documents, but also about the psychology of the person organising it. What would your personal archive tell us about your psychology?
Well, what I meant by that is sort of what I alluded to earlier, is the idea that the way you organize a set of documents is indicative of how you see the world or how you frame the world. I don't really organize my own documents, so I don't know that they would say that much other than that I'm really disorganized and my brain sort of can leap between a lot of different things at once, sometimes too quickly. I learned a lot about myself throughout, you know, my academic work, partly because my academic work also, you know, spans from when I was like 21 to when I was like 29, which is really a lot of changes happening in everybody's lives, probably around those ages. And through my academic work, there were just sort of shifts in my focus or, you know, sort of my philosophy towards teaching, towards like literary research, kind of ways that I reconsidered maybe different priorities. I think there was a lot of personal growth there. I think that the process of writing a novel is more intimate to me. It requires you to dig really deep, because ultimately, if you're writing for me, it's about imagining like who these characters are, how they react to things, what they would do in a specific situation, kind of imagining them in a really specific level. And so it's becoming really honest with myself about the way that I perceive the world and the way that other people would perceive the world. And so I think that's a really educational experience. I also think the process of going through publishing anything is, I think, very, very growth oriented and tells you a lot about yourself and like your own vulnerabilities and relationship to the world around you.
On this question of kind of vulnerability and even terror, I was really struck by a line from your character, Miranda, in a pivotal moment in the novel. Miranda says, "Art is supposed to upset you. Art is supposed to make you feel afraid." And I wondered, could this also apply to archives? Should archives also upset us and make us feel afraid?
I think that it depends on the archive, you know, on its purpose. I mean, what I was trying to get across with that line is, I think there's this pressure on artists to communicate something that is really raw and vulnerable and to create a reaction in the reader or the viewer. And you want to create that reaction. And so then when you experience that reaction, whether it's in relationship to the act of creation or in relationship to something else, in Miranda's case, she's very afraid at that moment that she says that, because she's in this terrible situation. She's in this terrible abusive marriage. So I think that for her is her kind of trying to justify that to herself and say that there's, you know, something greater that she is creating. And I guess I would say that, you know, hopefully archives, which are kind of these remnants of people's lives, sometimes really traumatic moments in people's lives and sort of testimonies to what really is kind of an incommunicable like experience, because it's so personal and individual, you know, hopefully archives of those materials are able to like use those and present them in a way that kind of speaks to a larger experience as well. And I think that that's a noble pursuit, is not to say that all the documents in an archive are the same, but to say that, you know, they give context to each other and that we can learn something from this person's difficult moment. I don't know that it helps that person that much, unfortunately. So that's where the ethical side comes in. But I do think that that's the thought that goes into archiving.
So we're going to have to wrap up in a minute, but I've got a final question about the research process. There's a violent death at the center of your novel, Miranda's death, and it turns into a kind of a whodunit, although not of the Agatha Christie variety, but it's a mystery around her violent death. And gendered violence is definitely a theme, and Miranda herself has always been fascinated by violence and violence inflicted upon herself. So many of her photographs, in fact, her most famous photographs, are of her slashing her own body and taking photos of the blood that pools in her ear or drips from her hand. I was really fascinated to learn about your master's research and that you had looked at suffragette activism and the slashing of paintings, in that sense, the desecration of visual archives. And so I'm wondering whether your own intellectual research background informed your characterization of Miranda. Was that an opportunity to play with these larger ideas of gendered violence and in fact, the violence that women inflict upon themselves or other women?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a topic I'm really interested in, and both that research project and the novel are sort of different ways of approaching it, for sure. I think one thing that really interests me about women inflicting violence is the ways that that violence is then read afterward is often somewhat incongruous with the intention behind it. So in the example of the suffragette art vandals, there's sort of this lore that still persists, you know, that it was just sort of like a symbolic attack on images of women that were represented by the male gaze. But that's not true, actually. You know, a lot were just like random portraits of random people or landscapes. And in reality, they were choosing objects based on their financial value, because the entire point of it was to create a financial pressure on the crown. Their crimes of opportunity, so what's closest, and their terrorist acts, so they're designed to like create fear. So the fear is more about the idea of this woman who, you know, is expected to be behaving in a certain way, being in a museum with a knife or with acid, you know, that she's hidden, and then taking part in this. So I think similarly in the novel, that was something I wanted to explore, was how some of Miranda's intentions with the representation of violence, the reasons that she's sort of like instinctively drawn to representing these really gory scenes. Sometimes it's, you know, an instinct she hasn't really even thought through. And then afterward, people who are seeing the art objects are sort of interpreting it in a variety of ways that may or may not match up with what she intended, right? And so I think like there are a lot of things that interest me about gendered violence and the intersection of gender and violence. But I do think in both of those, the speed with which people read women's acts of violence as representative of, quote, being crazy, of some kind of mental illness, of being unstable in some way.
Yeah, we've got Sarah's dog there. Hi, Sarah. Your dog's telling you it's time to wrap up the interview as well, because she's ready for a walk.
Oh my gosh, I didn't realize you could hear him.
No, it's great.
Sorry. Okay.
No, this is the new Zoom order. We're all used to it. It's fantastic.
I know. I'm so sorry. I thought my headphones were masking his wild barking. So all of those attributions that people give to women committing violence, I think, are really interesting, especially because often it's not coming from that place. So the kind of fear that's created by women in particular committing violent acts, I think, is really interesting and is something I wanted to explore.
Sarah, one final question that we ask all our guests here on Archives Anonymous. We like to think of this as a kind of confessional space. So we're wondering if you have a dirty little archive secret that you might be willing to share with us here today.
Oh, you know, I do have one. Okay. It was in an archive in London. And, you know, you're going through all these documents and like there's all these different envelopes. They're very fragile. Of course, I like ripped one of the envelopes and I was just like horrified. Maybe not even the envelope. Maybe it was like a document I like accidentally ripped part of. And I was horrified and I was just like, I can never confess. The thing to do is just to like close this and leave it behind. So, you know, somewhere there is some document that I clearly remember like accidentally ripping. And the fact that I still remember this, you know, 10 years later is probably an indication of the type of personality that I am.
The things that haunt the dreams of archive addicts. I'm afraid that's all we have time for today. It's been wonderful to talk to you, Sarah. Thank you so much for coming along.
Thank you so much for having me. It was really fun.
To learn more about Sarah's work, you can check out her website, sarahsliger.com. Take Me Apart is published in Australia by Text Publishing, and you can order your copy of the book via the Text website or from your local independent bookstore. We just know you're going to devour it.
Don't forget that you can catch up on all of season 1 and 2 via our website, archivefeverpod.com.
Until our next therapeutic session, I'm Claire Wright.
And I'm Eve Rees.
And you've been listening to Archive Fever, a La Trobe University podcast recorded and produced by Matt Smith on unceded Wurundjeri land.
Our theme music is by Poddington Bear. You can hear more at soundofpicture.com. And you can follow Claire on Twitter at Claire A. Wright.
And you can follow Eve on Twitter at Eve Rees. And you can follow Sarah on Twitter at Sarah X. Sliger.
coming up on the next episode.
What did one of his grandchildren said, oh, that's the smoking gun, you know, you've got the smoking gun. Yeah, okay, I guess that's true, I did. But I had much more than the smoking gun.